every year after year, more and more tents pop up on my block, in my park next to my house, as more and more people, you know, are displaced out of their homes. Just watching inequality play out right here at the tip of the spear, the fifth largest economy in the world, is something I wanted to be part of the resistance around.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight. Natalie Foster is co-founder of the Economic Security Project, which seeks to provide a guaranteed base income to people in the United States. Natalie has one of the more noteworthy careers in the intersection of organizing, politics, and technology. She worked, among other places, in online organizing at Move On, the Sierra Club, the DNC or OFA, as well as working with Van Jones to co-found and run Rebuild the Dream. She's now a veteran political entrepreneur and in good company working with Chris Hughes, her co-founder at the Economic Security Project, who was co-founder at Facebook and a leader in Obama's 2008 online campaign. When you talk to Natalie, you come to understand her deep interest in fighting economic inequality and the strong background she brings to that arena. So I was pleased to talk to Natalie about her path, about the project, and how she thinks it fits into the politics of our time. Now we have a quick word with our sponsor, and then my interview with Natalie Foster at the Economic Security Project.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Natalie. I wonder if you could introduce yourself and give me a quick biography.
Sure. My name is Natalie Foster. I am the co-chair and co-founder of the Economic Security Project, which fights for a guaranteed income in the United States. And I'm a senior fellow at the Aspen Institute Future of Work Initiative. I'm a lifelong organizer sitting right at the intersection of social movements and technology. Spent the first part of my career thinking about digital tools and organizing at MoveOn.org and for the President Obama's digital team. And then jumped over to the issue side of things and have spent the second half of my career thinking about how we move big ideas into the mainstream and think a lot about how the big idea of a guaranteed income should really be part of the larger set of ideas that are being discussed today through my lens on the Economic Security Project, and also how work will change as we move forward at my perch at Aspen.
That's a pretty exciting place to be. And I want to kind of go into your career a little bit because you have so many great jobs, but I want to ask you a little bit about the Economic Security Project first. It seems like a heavy lift for the United States to get to a guaranteed income. And there's something about our political culture, not just the power that the wealthy have, but also something embedded deep in the American creed of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. And I wonder how you guys are working on that with those things in mind.
Yeah, well, you're not wrong. Focus group after focus group over the course of the last 2 years of the Economic Security Project's life has certainly reinforced that the American work ethic is deeply embedded in people, even people who would work their entire lives at a minimum wage and still not be able to feed their family. Even people working at that wage level feel like they don't want a handout. They don't want to be beholden to anyone, that they've worked their lives to make sure that they're not. And so we did a lot of thinking about when the universal basic income sort of entered into the conversation this time around, it was very much about technology. And it was divorced from its roots, its justice roots, right? Dr. King talked about a guaranteed income or a job. The Black Panther's 10-point plan, which was the vanguard of radical politics, talked about a guaranteed income or a job. The idea of guaranteeing an income so that everyone has an economic floor from which to start is actually an old idea rooted in justice, and our current moment had forgotten that. Part of what we wanted to do at the Economic Security Project was rediscover that through line into today's conversation, where 50 years later, from when Dr. King was talking about a guaranteed income in his last book, Where We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, 50 years later, we've seen wages stagnant that entire time, while we've seen extraordinary economic growth, right? So wages and work have been decoupled for decades, while the American worker receives very little. But yet those who have a lot in society have seen that grow exponentially. And so it's been broken. And so let's think about guaranteeing an income to shift that.
Tell me, what is the goal then of the Economic Security Project?
Well, the goal is to figure out what a guaranteed income could look like in America today and make it happen. We've supported Mayor Michael Tubbs in Stockton, California, to be the first demonstration of a guaranteed income in a U.S. city. So the mayor, he's this extraordinary mayor. If folks aren't familiar with him, I highly recommend Googling him. He's 29 years old. He's the first young Black mayor of Stockton, California, which is a very diverse city in the Central Valley of California. And it's a city that was the first big American city to go bankrupt before Detroit. And it's pulled itself out of that situation. But Mayor Tubbs is of a generation that knows his generation will do worse than their parents if we don't change the tide of, you know, the American economy. So trying out big ideas was a natural to him, the way he tells it. So he's launched the Stockton Economic Empowerment Demonstration, the first, you know, demonstration of the idea in Stockton, and his team will start disbursements shortly. There's a handful of families, about 100 families, who will receive $500 a month with no strings attached for the next year or so as a way of understanding what it means to have an economic floor that you can count on every single month, in addition to whatever wages you earn and other sorts of income you have.
So that's not very much. I'm sure it's very welcome. What do you imagine will change?
Well, I imagine that the individual lives of people will look a bit different. There's an excellent research team led by PhDs out of University of Tennessee and Pennsylvania who've put together a really interesting qualitative and quantitative research plan to walk alongside the folks in Stockton who will participate in the demonstration. I think you'll see like a bit less stress in people's lives when they know there's this steady bit of income. I think you'll see, you know, perhaps some shifts in if people are able to go back to school, not have to take on a second job, that sort of thing. And it might just be just a little less, you know, stress each month. We'll see. But the one thing I'm looking forward to in the study is it'll be one of the first studies to look at income volatility. It's something that people have studied over the course of, you know, years, but we know incomes change dramatically now week to week and certainly month to month when the bills are paid. Jobs will schedule you 29 hours one week and then, you know, maybe the full 40 hours you're supposed to be working the next week, and your paycheck reflects that. And so often you can't make rent. And that's one of the things the researchers will be looking at using text messaging and other pretty innovative research tools in Stockton. So that's what on the micro level will be interesting and will be really important research to add to the lexicon of research. But the truth is already the conversation nationally around what people deserve and what sort of economy we want to have has shifted a bit because of the mayor's leadership in Stockton. And not just because of that, but it's part of a larger zeitgeist of people recognizing we cannot continue down the same path. It doesn't work for most Americans to live hand to mouth, and it doesn't really work for democracy to have so many people right on the edge. And so let's think about different ways to challenge today's system. there's been an over-reliance on markets, an over-reliance on privatization. What does it look like to have public goods? What does it look like to really ask ourselves, you know, what do we owe one another as a society, not just how do I get mine? I think there are a lot of people asking those questions now, and I feel like we have lawmakers newly installed who are asking those questions, and hopefully that'll be part of the presidential primary over the next 2 years as well.
There's definitely a hunger in the Democratic primary electorate for big ideas. How is this particular idea so far playing into the very nascent campaign?
Well, I think we're seeing some really interesting anti-poverty bills put forward that include cash. So for example, Kamala Harris has put forward something called the Lift the American Middle Class Act. And that is an additional tax credit that would give every American household who makes under $100,000 as a household $500 a month, no strings attached, to deal with the rising cost of living. That's a really big idea. And I think an exciting one. You have Sherrod Brown alongside Bennett from Colorado, who's put forward a child allowance, which is something actually every developed nation in the world has, except United States, which is a stipend for raising children and dealing with the cost of children. Cory Booker has, you know, his baby bonds idea, which basically says, you know, there are a lot of children whose parents are able to put money aside at birth, and it grows over time as the market grows. And we as a society should do that for every baby, which is a really important way of starting to deal with the racial wealth gap. Inequality is dramatic, but the racial wealth gap, when you start to break it down along racial lines, is even more dramatic. And so there's no way to deal with that just with jobs. You know, even if we raise wages to, you know, $15 an hour, which we absolutely should, we'll also have to be thinking about the wealth those children have. And I would argue that the additional income that families should have to make up for the fact that over the last 50 years, they were owed something, but wage stagnation meant they didn't receive it.
If you could wave a wand, what do you think a floor amount of resources that people would get would be?
I think if I could wave a wand, I mean, look, I think what Stockton is doing with $500 a month is really exciting. I think it's a place to start. I fundamentally think that what we need to do today is lay the pipes for people to receive income support alongside the rest of their work lives. And within that, we should expand the definition of work. We all know that, you know, there are jobs which have a traditional income, and then there's a lot of work that is being done outside of that traditional income. I'm thinking of caregiving, people who take care of elderly parents, disabled family members, children who aren't compensated for it, but it's incredible work. They're often stepping out of the labor market to do that and having, you know, lost wages because of that. And I also think of students who are in school, who are working, who are studying. We know they're also working, and in many cases now they're working more than they're studying. But what if we counted that as work that was good for society? So lay the pipes, expand the definition of work, you know, make this income floor monthly. And then as we do or do not see disruptions in the labor market, depending on which, you know, economist and forecasters you talk to, whether or not AI will or will not have a big impact on the workforce, whether or not, you know, automation will, whether or not new jobs will be created, we'll have the groundwork and can turn it up or turn it down, depending on what's needed. And so I think $500 a month is a great place to start. We've put together a policy we're calling a cost of living refund. And if you take California, for example, you could say that in the state, every Californian who makes under $75,000 a year should receive the cost of living refund. So that's about half of the state. And let's make it monthly. And let's expand the definition of work to include unpaid caregivers and students in California. You would significantly reduce poverty, and you'd significantly start to reduce income volatility that's moved, you know, its way into the middle class. That's something we could do in California today. it's expensive, but it's not near as expensive as the insecurity and inequality that is deeply impacting this otherwise very prosperous state. And that's what we're interested in, is like, how do we connect the big idea to something that could happen today in the tax code?
What's the founding story for the Economic Security Project? How did you get it going?
I've been very interested in economic ideas and how they, you know, move into the mainstream, and was interested in the conversation that was growing around a universal basic income. And like I said earlier, it was very dominated by tech at the time. It was very much on sort of a futures, will the robots come or will they not predication. And hosted a bunch of conversations and realized Chris Hughes, who's my fellow co-founder and a Facebook co-founder, was also interested in a set of questions. He had come at it from the international development space. GiveDirectly has done some really interesting experiments in Kenya. And what would it look like to think about cash transfers domestically? And Dorian Warren, our third co-founder, had done really interesting work thinking about how do you think about reparations and a universal basic income together? How do you sort of think of a targeted universalism, and what would that mean for the racial wealth gap and other racial disparities? We decided that was a conversation that other people should have, and let's form an organization to answer a bunch of questions, frankly, that we had at the time. Is this a good idea? How would we pay for it? What should it actually look like? And so we launched Economic Security Project to do just that. We launched it 2 years ago in the wake of a very shocking election for all of us. And we asked a bunch of questions. So we commissioned research on how much would it cost? What sort of growth, though, could you expect from the American economy? Could you expect growth from the American economy if more money were just injected into people's pockets? The answer is you would see about a 5% growth, said the Roosevelt Institute. They also put together a lit review of all the different cash transfer studies that have been done in the United States and Canada, which are dozens. And what were the impacts that we've seen across the board? When people have more cash, their lives are better. Their stress levels go down. Birth weights go up. They stay in school longer. Indicator after indicator after indicator. And you see that too in Alaska, where for the past 40 years, there has been a dividend paid out to every Alaskan resident, man, woman, and child, from a sovereign wealth fund, which is a fund set aside where a governor, a Republican governor, took the oil royalties for opening up a new part of Alaska to oil drilling and put all the royalties into a fund owned by Alaska that pays out the dividend. And so it's this really interesting model that we have and a natural experiment that we have where people don't see it as part of a handout. They see it as their commonly owned wealth. And it makes perfect sense that they receive this check every year from the state. It comes in a lump sum. It's debited directly into their accounts, and it's anywhere between $1,000 and $3,000. We commissioned some research on, you know, how do people use that money? And it turns out to be very popular, as you could imagine. So popular that people would rather institute a sales tax than get rid of it. And that is in a pretty red state. So it was helpful to understand the role it plays in people's lives. And could we imagine actually an American dividend, you know, extrapolated out from Alaska with a different revenue source, you know, a non-extractive revenue source. And so that's some of the work we were able to do in the early years. But over the past year, we've come to realize, you know, we could do it today. We can use the tax code. We could create a cost of living refund, pay for it by those who've done well in the new economy, and we could do it at the state level. So that's what we've set to do with a bunch of partners in a dozen states, is try and over the course of the next 2 years, prove the concept that you can modernize and expand the existing tax code, the earned income tax code, the part of the tax code that gives out money to people at the lowest part of the income bracket, expand it dramatically, who is eligible for it, and modernize it update the definition of work, make it monthly, make it automatic so that people don't have to go through all that work and pretty predatory work often at tax prep sites to file their taxes when the government knows exactly how much they make, you know, automatically issue the refund and prove the case over the course of the next 2 years in a state to inform eventually a federal response in 2021.
It's a ambitious and interesting project, and I hope you make a lot of progress with it. Can I kind of go through your career starting at the beginning to help understand how you get to join with a Facebook co-founder and launch something like this, which not everybody is positioned to do? What happened to you coming right out of college that launched your career?
I did a year-long fellowship right out of college that was an organizing fellowship. And that was a really powerful year. It sort of took my nascent activist tendencies and funneled them into a worldview, which is, you know, there's two sources of power. There's people and there's money. And it's our job to organize people to demand the things we need across, you know, all parts of social change. And so that just made a lot of sense to me. And, you know, I'm the daughter of a preacher from Kansas. My father, growing up, like, did something very similar. The difference is he was aimed at sort of, you know, getting people to heaven in the next world. And I became very interested in making this world a better place. And so it might be a craft that sort of runs in the family. But then the big shift for me, I spent many years as a community organizer in Georgia in the South with the Sierra Club. The big shift for me was the advent of digital, which has been your life's work too. I was fairly early at MoveOn.org. And that going from spending several weeks with my volunteers, training them to hold press conferences across the state, you know, maybe I could pull together three to sort of call on the governor to do something, take weeks and weeks of work. And it would be great, great, great opportunities for my volunteers and have a big impact on the campaign. Going to MoveOn.org, where, you know, at that time we were fighting the war in Iraq, there would be a terrible development, and over 24 hours, we could mobilize tens of thousands of people to take action all across the nation with, you know, different messages in each district, depending on, you know, what the lawmaker thought. That was a mind-blowing experience and offered so much in the way of organizing that now is sort of just how things are done. But at the time was pretty exciting.
What was transformative in what you learned during that? Oh, I don't know, almost 2 years that you were there.
Well, one is that there are very committed and very talented people all over the country who are tuned in to national news and want desperately to weigh in and change the course of the way things are going. And alone feel pretty powerless, but connected are quite powerful. And that ability to connect the local, like people who know their member of Congress because they showed up at that person's rallies and polling places, to weigh in to that member, connected to people doing that all over the country, is a really powerful force. It turned out to be the kind of force that could, you know, elect a little known candidate named Barack Obama. That would happen, you know, years later. The kind of force that would like eventually stop a war in Iraq. So I think that, and eventually like pass the Affordable Care Act, there is something very powerful in it. I think I see now as just sort of the way organizing is happening right now, that the sort of disconnect between digital and on the ground organizing has broken down. I feel like any organizer today knows how to think about digital tools as well as the basics of relationship. And I think that's an exciting evolution in the craft.
After that, you went to Sierra Club, is that right?
No, after MoveOn, I ran Obama's digital team. That was 2009 to 2010. You're right. I did go back to the Sierra Club. We launched a digital team.
I'm looking at your LinkedIn, so, you know.
Yeah.
I don't want to get into the argument with you about your career, but that seems like what came next.
Oh, Nathaniel. Yes, that's right. You know, the Sierra Club was like almost the opposite experience of MoveOn, right? MoveOn had millions of members diffuse throughout the country that could come together in these particular moments when there was like a national call. And to do anything regional or local was hard. It would literally take the same amount of energy, like the same amount of staff time to do something at the city level than it would the national level. And so, you know, you got the biggest bang for your buck. And certainly people responded in a way when there were national moments. The Sierra Club, however, had 100 years of an organization that built itself slowly, like little d democratically across the country, you know, building chapter after chapter after chapter. It's a deep investment from people at the local level. And it wasn't actually great at mobilizing when there were national moments. And increasingly that was really important. And so we had to build the opposite almost in many ways. Like how do you build a national digital program that respects the local autonomy that the Sierra Club has? And I think it's a challenge they've, you know, made great strides in, but definitely still one they have today.
I mean, it's pretty hard to change a organization that's been around a long time, to change the tactics, to change the wiring inside. Was it hard in there to be in the middle of that, or did it go fairly smoothly?
No, it was really complicated. I mean, I think that, you know, things at the Sierra Club take longer because there's a lot of buy-in required from the like local group level, which is like kind of the city level, to the chapter level, which is like the state level. But then once it's there, people do extraordinary things with it. So I had to learn to slow down, work with through the process, get buy-in, teach people how to use the tools, how to think about, you know, online organizing. And the payoff was worth it if you work through the process.
So you did then go after Obama won and got an office to the DNC and Organizing for America as digital director. How was that?
Well, I often joke it was the least sexy time to be in Obama land possible. I mean, everyone had come together in this extraordinary election. And honestly, I remember when I got the call from Judith Freeman saying, hey, you know, they're looking for somebody who has an organizing background because they want to keep this thing going. These 13 million people that came together to elect this president, they're going to keep it going. And at the time, it felt like a really big deal. It hadn't really been done before. And what would it mean to govern? It felt like the kind of question that needed to be answered. What would it mean to govern with alongside these people who elected you, who are going to hold you accountable, who are going to, but also, you know, sort of be the wind at your back. And so that was the challenge we set out to solve. And there were moments over the course of the 2 years that my team and I were there of, you know, some of the proudest moments of my career in organizing. Certainly one of them was passing the Affordable Care Act from the claws of defeat, which it was nearly in time after time after time. After that summer of Tea Party rebellion, where they, you know, the Tea Party did an incredible job of disrupting town halls and making their voice heard, and it scared the Democrats in a way that was just so shameful. And, you know, we had to recover from that. We had to out-organize from that. But I won't lie, you know, it was also very hard. Organizing requires you to have a campaign, you know, to tell a story, to say, here's how when we come together, this is how we'll accomplish something. And to name the enemy, to say, here's who needs to be moved in order to get this, and here's who's standing in the way. And that wasn't really how the administration was working in those first few years. It was definitely challenging, but it was a great team at the time, many of whom are off doing exciting things. Jess Morales, the political director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance now, Betsy Hoover running Higher Ground Labs. It was a great crew at the time. I think we did a work I'm really proud of.
I interviewed both of those two people, and very impressive that you just mentioned. There are other episodes in the podcast about that. The conventional wisdom is that the kind of the amazing campaign of Obama in 2008 didn't continue to back the policy initiatives. What's your take on whether, I mean, it sounded like you thought it wasn't fully incorporated into the way the White House was working.
Well, it wasn't. And like, look, the White House was focused on like pulling the economy back from the brink of recession, right?
Yeah. There's only so much they can do at the same time.
and we're figuring out how they want it to govern. What I'll say to that is it's certainly the Obama coalition splintered. And there were progressives who really had a clear sense of how the health reform should look, were really disappointed, you know, and things like not including the public option from the beginning. So there was a loud and very important group of people holding the president accountable who felt like Organizing for America was absolutely not doing that. Organizing America for America wasn't actually set up to hold the president accountable. It was set up to push Congress and to mobilize when needed. And here's what I'll say about that, because it was Congress that was in many ways very intransigent, and extraordinary partisan politics were played during that time, still are today for sure, but were very much played during that time. We had a lot of people for whom the Affordable Care Act was the reason they had voted for Barack Obama and was the reason they stayed involved. And literally their lives depended on it. Millions of people like this, for a loved one, for themselves, and they stayed engaged with us the whole way. We actually had millions of new people join during that time, during the Affordable Care Act fight, because people who'd never been politically active definitely did not think their voice mattered in American politics, but showed up at a congressional office when we did surprise visits to tell their horrifying healthcare story. People who joined small dollar ad buys we were taking out in local newspapers to tell their story, you know, told their stories on video to make local ads that our digital team was creating. There was really important organizing that was happening. It wasn't part of the dominant story. I think that's just how it will go down.
So at this point, you know, you're only out of college less than a decade, and you've been in the center of online organizing for an environmental group, for Move On, which is certainly a big player in progressive space, and for the DNC and Organizing for America. What was next for you?
After the midterms, my partner, Matt Ewing, who also is a lifelong organizer, and I decided we wanted to move to the West Coast, that DC was going to be fine without us. And Matt had some startup ideas he wanted to pursue. So we moved out to the Bay Area. Here's what I know. The internet is like good when something is already at a tipping point and we need to mobilize people to get it over the finish line. Or it is good at stopping something, you know, people showing outrage collectively and in decentralized ways. But it's not particularly good at the long, slow work of building something over time. Or at least I hadn't gotten to do that sort of thing. So it felt like to me, climate and inequality are the two most existential crises of our time. I wanted to work on inequality. It's personal, and it's something that, you know, living in California, watching this incredibly prosperous state every year after year, more and more tents pop up on my block, in my park next to my house, as more and more people, you know, are displaced out of their homes. Just watching inequality play out right here at the tip of the spear, the fifth largest economy in the world, is something I wanted to be part of the resistance around. And so Van Jones and I teamed up to launch something called Rebuild the Dream.
How did you know Van?
Of course, I knew who he was as, you know, the green jobs advocate, a hero in the environmental space. And then we'd connected in the Obama administration. Van was connecting up folks who came out of social movements and were in DC to be sort of in relationship with one another while they were in the midst of this big administration. And so he turned his attention to the economy, and I teamed up with him. I was CEO of Rebuild the Dream. Van was president. The idea was there's this thing called the Tea Party out there that has taken over, you know, politics on right of center. It's been very powerful. We know we have the same kind of energy left of center, but there's no unifying voice. We're all sort of speaking in different in our issue silos. So let's pull it together under something we were calling the American Dream Movement, and let's move forward and you know, disrupt politics on the left. A couple months later, so we did this, we had this great conference, and you know, all these different folks were, you know, I'm the president of NARAL, and I'm part of the American Dream Movement. You know, I work on student debt forgiveness, and I'm part of the American Dream Movement. Not 2 months later, Occupy Wall Street launched. And if we had studied the Tea Party, they had studied Arab Spring and tapped into this deep, deep anger that existed at that time and absolutely still does, you know, that we see on display and electing presidents. That tactic of people sleeping out, you know, to challenge a budget crisis in New York spread like wildfire in ways that even the organizers weren't prepared for. And while we had spent all this energy trying to get groups to organize things together, and that, like, there were infighting and the dates weren't working, and this other thing, this leaderful movement, just spread like wildfire without the groups, outside of the groups, in fact, had the groups racing to catch up. And it was a really powerful moment for me in my career where I realized, A, we had put forward this idea that, you know, wasn't actually the right idea for the time, which is a very useful thing to get to be part of in your career. Because so often in social change, we like try and make things work, and like that didn't work. And I got to see firsthand the power of momentum in organizing, and momentum is something I think deeply undervalued in our craft, and what it meant to see people like stepping into leadership roles all over the country. And so decided like that's something we should pay closer attention to as we move forward. You know, continued on the like social entrepreneur, you know, Van and I continued to do interesting work. I moved to do sort of more future of work type organizing after that. And then saw a similar type of momentum in the universal basic income conversation. Like saw this idea taking off, lots of people talking about it, a huge like subreddit around basic income. In fact, at the time, like 2 years ago, there were reporters in different outlets like Vox who had and Quartz who had like a UBI beat because they knew that anytime they wrote something about the universal basic income, like it was well read and spread around the internet. And thought, all right, so this is a conversation about who has and who doesn't, about essentially redistribution and deservedness. And let's go see what's there. So really was kind of one of the animating drives to launch the Economic Security Project, to step into the momentum and connect it back to its justice roots, to build out some of the intellectual work around it, and to start supporting cities and mayors and leaders to decide what it looks like for themselves in this modern era. And so that's where we are.
It's an interesting place to be. I wonder how you think about the 2020 election through this lens, because I think there's this notable tension right now in the party between a fair amount of people who are saying, we got to run on something. We have to have bold aims. We have to make a lot of change and aim for a lot of transformation of society because there's a lot of stuff messed up. And other people who are worried, perhaps, that some of those idealistic measures that might serve us well might not play well in the election and might be things that empower the other side to run against. Where are you on that?
Well, look, we're having a conversation about marginal tax rates in DC, which is a very far cry from where we were even 3 months ago, even 4 months ago. And what we're finding is that we have presidential candidates with a wealth tax proposal, which anyone will tell you who studies inequality, that we cannot solve inequality, even shrink the dramatic gap in inequality by incomes alone, meaning people's paychecks, that no longer are people gaining wealth from their incomes and haven't actually for a long time. The only way to actually gain wealth is if you have wealth, right? If you have capital, capital is what gains capital. So we need to look at people's real estate holdings, like their entire net worth, their wealth. And that is how we should determine, you know, who's done well in this economy and what they owe back to society, not just their income alone.
But it's exactly that sort of eyeball on the wealth of the very wealthy, the very powerful people that gets them all riled up to stop it and mobilizes some of the power against you. I mean, I'm not saying that's a good reason to do it, but it's definitely the case.
Maybe that's true. But the thing I'm seeing is that poll after poll shows that people support this, that they're tired of going to schools that are falling apart, last week, my son, it was announced in Oakland. Oakland is, our school district is millions of dollars in debt. It was in state receivership for a while. They announced they're closing my son's school because they think that, you know, it can save money in a larger school. And it is that like race to the bottom where we recognize, wait a second, California for the past 40 years has hamstrung itself by not asking our businesses to pay property values at current rates. That was a law that was passed in a very different time in California, in a very fiscally irresponsible moment in California's history, where they froze property taxes at rates in the 70s, and they never went up. So everyone now has seen headlines about the extraordinary real estate boom in the Bay Area and how very expensive it is, and how, you know, average home prices are, you know, $2 million. Rent has gone up. Meanwhile, every business in the state hasn't paid any taxes on that explosive growth in property value. And that has meant, you know, $10 billion a year that haven't gone to schools, that haven't gone to firefighters and different government employees, teachers. And so here we are in a place where, you know, teachers are going on strike because they aren't paid enough to live, because schools are overcrowded. And you know, my son's school is closing. So if you look at Prop 13, is long considered to be a third rail in California politics. Like, no one can pick it up. The governor would never talk about it. And things have totally changed. Poll after poll shows that people absolutely will support making companies in the state pay their fair share of property taxes. And I think that is true nationwide. People are feeling the impact of starving the country. There are people who are saying, yeah, you should tax me more. I'm thinking of Ray Dalio, the hedge funder, who's saying that from Davos. I'm thinking of Nick Hanauer, the first investor in Amazon, who's for a long time been clinging the bell that we have to, that those who've done well in the economy have to pay their fair share in order for democracy to work. And I think of my colleague, Chris Hughes, who wrote a book saying an economy that runs like a lottery, where a very few number of people get very lucky and that's it, is no way to run an economy. His book's called Fair Shot, and he sort of walks through his life. There are people who are speaking sense in this moment.
I think that's right. I think it does feel like we are, you know, we may be tipping towards a real opening in the political opportunity structure to make big change.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just having Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, what she's talking about, how she's talking about it, when she calls into Twitch, a live stream, and chats about transgender rights and inequality with gamers, or when she's like on the floor of Congress talking about marginal tax rates, which are three words probably that haven't been uttered in a really long time in Washington, D.C., for the exact fear you're talking about. People are responding in pretty extraordinary ways, and I think it's opening up new political space. I think even the idea of calling for a Green New Deal, the type of thing that brings together climate and inequality, and that says we are the country that put a man on the moon. We are a country that could build high-speed rail, you know, that could make our buildings completely efficient. We just have to decide that's what we want to do, and we have to invest back in American society. And we have to do it in a way that is open to everyone. My family is very much a product of the New Deal. We were Dust Bowl Okies, poor Oklahoma farmers who loaded up in the car during the Dust Bowl and went to California to seek their fortune and didn't find it. They're from Woody Guthrie's hometown in Oklahoma. And it was through the New Deal, the investment in American society, where my grandfather and my uncles were able to go to college on the GI Bill. I had a good government job with a pension as a postmaster and a school superintendent, was a business owner. That brought my family into the middle class and offered us a sense of stability. And I know it was because of the color of our skin. When I think about the next New Deal and a Green New Deal, I'm really heartened and want to absolutely fight for making it available to everyone, Black, brown, white, all race and gender, and make sure that that we do it in a way that lifts everyone up.
You have been part of starting a number of organizations now. Do you have advice to other people who are working to be kind of political entrepreneurs?
thanks to ecosystems like New Media Ventures and Higher Ground Labs and early entrepreneurs like NGP Van and others, we have actually really good tools now that are pretty cheap. So you can spin something up quickly. Advice part one is do that. Don't spend a lot of money on tools. You know, duct tape it together with what's off the shelf to test out, you know, your hypothesis, particularly if you're starting a campaign. I think about what Paid Family Leave campaign that Katie Bethel and team run over at Plus. It started with a very simple change.org petition and a campaign built around a petition around a mother who had experienced great loss because she didn't have paid family leave. She'd had to go right back to work. And it was a powerful story, and it took off. And now they've built an organization that has organizers on the ground and a political team and lobbying and the whole bit. But they started with a simple story and a big idea that America should have paid family leave like every other, you know, developed nation in the world. One is that we have cheap tools. Use them. Don't spend a whole lot of setup time before you get started on your idea. I think that's my best advice. And, you know, two is like, get clear on your theory of the case and just start walking the road. Like, don't overthink it. You know, don't take a deck and talk to funders at the expense of actually doing the work. Just start walking the road. And then, you know, I promise your theory of the case will change, but make sure you have one. It's clear, you can articulate it, and you get started walking it as you go.
Thank you very much, Natalie. Is there a question I should have asked that you'd like to answer?
Yeah, I feel like one of the great parts of my work is intersecting with all these other extraordinary thinkers. And so, you know, one question I love getting asked is who else I think is doing great work right now?
Who else do you think is doing great work right now?
You know, one of my points of inspiration is the National Domestic Workers Alliance and Aijin Poo, who runs it, and Palak Shah, who runs their innovation lab. I have spent the last 5-6 years thinking about the future of work, doing some organizing of workers in sort of the future of work space. And the thing that's interesting about domestic work is it really was the original gig workers, and still very much is today. This is work that was carved out of labor law when it passed in the 40s and 50s as a concession to Southern Democrats. So that's why you have domestic workers, both house cleaners and caregivers, who don't even qualify for minimum wage, who can't legally join a union, even if it existed, which it doesn't. There's just something so powerful about having Aijin and her community of domestic workers fighting for better wages, for better conditions, but in very different employment circumstances than somebody who's worked in a factory. And so I have been really inspired by the organization and the muscle and the political power that she and the National Domestic Workers Alliance have built inside the future of workspace, but much more broadly for the care economy. It'll be the largest occupation by 2030, caregivers. We know it's the work that robots will never replace. And so if it continues to be an occupation that pays very low wages and has no benefits and protections, like, that's a very precarious situation for America. And if it continues to be the case that most American families don't have enough money to afford care, then we'll be in the crisis that is in fact looming. And so I just think that work is really important.
I had the good fortune to interview Aijin on the podcast a while ago, very compelling person, and obviously well-known around the country. Is there anyone else that comes to mind?
Yeah, I also think that tune into the work that Rise Up Retail is doing. Both Andrea Dellendorf and Eddie Eaney, who run it, but also the CTO, Kat. She is the first that I know to use AI in worker organizing. She built a platform called Work It, which is sort of a mutual aid platform for retail workers. Turns out that at Walmart, at least, you can't access the handbook that tells you what you're eligible for unless you're on your boss's computer during work time with your boss over your shoulder. So if you get sick, you don't know what you're eligible for. But anyone who's worked at Walmart for a period of time, like, actually knows the answer. So they, like, have this amazing story of downloading the handbook surreptitiously, like, pulling it together, so work, and realizing technology could actually solve this problem. And so built a platform that answers the basic questions that retail workers have. And she used IBM's Watson to answer the questions that kept coming up as a first line. And then the more complex questions get passed on to actual retail workers who are serving as mentors on the platform. So it's an interesting tool that is really part of a much larger strategy around uniting the service sector and retail workers who have very low wages, very little protections, and certainly no, you know, worker voice in the workplace.
Natalie, are you going to be doing this for a while, the security project, or where you want to take your career in life?
Oh, I don't know. I want to go where I have the biggest impact. I've never been someone who has a 10-year plan, 5-year plan. What, you know, we've committed to seeing this through the 2020 election. And then I think we'll hopefully move into a space where we're governing again and can start to implement some of these big ideas. What I know is that I think my life's work is to slow the tide around inequality and be part of a movement that dramatically reshapes the American economy. It just makes no sense that in the richest nation on earth, that we have poverty, that we have people on my block living in tents. That doesn't make sense. And we can change it. It's a political choice we're making. And so as an organizer, I want to build the power we need to turn the tide. And you are not wrong in pointing out how hard it is. With capital concentrated today at like 1929 levels, right before the Great Depression, it is not easy to take on that power. But we have to try. And we are also living in a moment where politics are shifting under our feet. You know, if you'd told me we'd be having a real conversation about the Green New Deal, I would have told you that's dumb branding. That feels old and staid. But when it comes out of the mouth of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on my Instagram story, it feels like fresh and new and interesting, and all the life is, you know, breathed into it from the organizing that's happening around it. And so, you know, I don't know where that will go, but I know it's opening up the type of conversation that absolutely has to happen. And as an organizer who believes in momentum, that's where we need to head.
You know, I was really heartened to see she was working with Senator Markey on it, because that kind of combines someone who's been steeped in it and thoughtful about it for a really long time with someone who's really impassioned and young and new. That gave me some real hope.
I absolutely agree. And I think we're going to see things like shockers like that weekly. At the same time, we're living through moments of, you know, horribleness. So I sort of what I'm pointing out is the political hope that keeps me going and sort of counters a lot of the killings, the shootings, the very difficult part of being alive today.
And the going backwards on policy in a national level. But it is heartening to me to talk to people like you who are doing this kind of work. I appreciate your time a great deal. I hope you have a great rest of the day.
Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon, Nathaniel.
That was Natalie Foster at the Economic Security Project. She's at economicsecurityproject.org. I look forward to seeing how Natalie and the Economic Security Project's push for guaranteed base income or other cash solutions to poverty moves forward. I think it could be part of making us a much better national community. This is Nathaniel G. Perlman with a Great Battlefield podcast. You can find us at resistancedashboard.com or by searching for Great Battlefield in places where podcasts are found.